Among those who are visiting in Anchorage for the Pioneer Convention is a wonderful gentleman named Charles Jones. And we consider it quite a privilege to have an opportunity to meet with and talk with this wonderful man, who tells me that he's 91 years old this year.
No, 86 years old.
86? Who told me you were 91? Why,
no.
You're just a young fella.
Yeah, just young.
I'd like you to go all the way back, Charlie, to when you first came to Alaska. What year was that?
1900.
And how, whatever possessed you to come this way?
Gypsy foot.
Where did you raise this gypsy foot?
Back at home, in Zanesville, Ohio.
Ohio?
Yes, mm-hmm. Ma'am.
What were you doing back there?
I was born and raised there.
Mm-hmm. So you decided you wanted to go to Alaska?
Well, I tell you, from the time I was a kid, the nursemaid had a big job keeping tab on me because I'd get away from her a chance I could and get out.
Uh-huh.
Anxious to see what was around the corner.
Mm-hmm.
I had that all my life.
And you ran out of corners in Ohio, so you had to look for another corner.
I was up in a business in Chicago. I had a newspaper delivery business there for the Chicago Tribune, along with a fellow named Booth.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't read the fine print. I found I was in on the losses and not on the profits, so I got out.
I see.
So I saw these advertisements about the Golden Sands of Nome and all this and that, you see, so I figured maybe that'd be a good place to get away to learn a little business. So I got out to Seattle and got in a steerage and came up here.
Several people have mentioned coming steerage. Charlie, what does that mean? What was that like when you came steerage?
You know what cargo hatches are on a on a freighter?
Mm-hmm.
Well, and they just didn't put cargo in one of these hatches, and they built up standees just about that far apart.
About 2 feet.
You mm-hmm. couldn't turn over very good in them.
Bunks, in other words.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And at $40 it cost for it. And
how many men would there be in one of these hatches?
Oh, I don't know. There was too many. I know that. And because when they'd get sick, you know, it was...
How many days did it take from Seattle?
12 days.
Did you go all the way to Nome?
Oh, yeah.
Right, straight to Nome.
Yeah.
You didn't,
well,
did
we,
you...
Oh, we stopped at Dutch Harbor and took on coal, and then we were in the ice. We got in the ice some time, too.
Mm.
Going slow.
What time of year was this? What month?
We got in there early in June.
Oh, and there was still ice then in the Bering Sea?
Oh, the ice was in the Bering Sea, yes. Always.
Did the ship actually get caught in the ice? Or
well, the ice was not in the pack, but it was broken in big leads, and we got in one lead that closed in on us, but it wasn't bad because it didn't come in with a force, and he just kept easing, and we got through all right now, see.
My goodness.
I mean, walrus all over the ice, and...
Well, that must have been interesting for a young fellow from Ohio.
Yeah.
What was Nome like when you got there?
Well, the record show, the Custom House record show, there was 40,000 people came to Nome in 1900. And it was just building everywhere, you know. It was just, there only been a few people there before, and they started that there in 1900. They really started to build everywhere. There'd been no banks there before, and there's two banks came and started up there. And the beach was just covered with men. Mine, you know, he couldn't stake on the beach. You could just buy a tent and work underneath what your tent covered, you see. And
but they were taking gold right on the beach there.
Right on the beach, yes, ma'am.
Well, what did you do, Charlie?
What
did you do first?
Everything. First thing I did was pack coal on my back to get enough money to eat my first meal.
Oh. Is that the first one you found?
No, that's the last one. When that idiot of Roosevelt told us we couldn't have our gold when we mined it, and put us on this idiotic, crazy idea of kind theory of credit and money.
Uh-huh. That's a pretty good size nugget.
$15.
Is that right?
Yeah.
About a half an inch across.
That's I kept that out on my last cleanup.
Mm-hmm.
I had to pay all the rest of it out to pay my bills. And
well, now let's back up. When you tossed that nugget out in front of me and derailed my train of thought, you were packing coal, you said, on your back.
Yeah.
Where'd the coal come from? Where'd
it
you find coal?
The barges. They brought off the boats and they packed it behind up beyond high water mark on the seas here, off of these barges. You back up to the barge and they give you a pack of coal on your back and you'd walk it up and dump it down over there. Two other fellas are stacking it.
So you started out and you got a steak that way, and then what'd you do next?
I got enough for breakfast.
Oh, well, that comes first, doesn't it?
And I went ahead from that. I did everything I could, you know. And I went to work there helping on the railroad and went to work on the water lines and went to work in the mines. And then I went to work on the mine and I stayed there, see.
Mm-hmm. Did you do, when did you do any mining for yourself?
Well, I tried that, but I didn't know how to save gold on that fine gold, you see. And you have to learn that, you see.
Yes, uh-huh.
And I didn't have a very good place at that, you see, because there's so many of them there.
What was the
So many of them there.
What was the method of mining there at Nome?
Well, they had everything. I know four fellas there, they had a built up an A-frame, and then had a big pendulum that they swung with a crankshaft on it to pump the water from the sea to put through a big long dom they had there. And some of them would swing it a while, and then others would pack the dirt in and work on the long dom. Then they had rockers. Most of them were rockers. Some of them had long doms. Some of them tried to sluice it. Well, the ones that tried to sluice it, I went to the end of their tail races and I found two big pans in there because
they were
very fine.
Yes, uh-huh.
And it's got a lot of ground up garnets in it and a lot of hematite iron, black sand, that's very heavy. So that unless you have plenty of riffles, agitation down in the boxes, they don't give it a chance to settle.
Mm-hmm. But all of these were methods of washing the gold out one way or another.
Out of the out of the sand. Gold naturally hates to travel. It's lazy and it likes to settle, especially in an eddy.
I see.
And you have it on they generally put it a foot to 12-foot boxes between 12-foot boxes where they foot and fall in that box, you see, and they have riffles in there. Out on the creeks where I worked afterwards, we had these ripples in there, and they were 2 inches they were, and they had this interspace in between them. They had blocks in there, and this gravel would come down and lodge in there, and the gold would creak in behind wherever the sagitation was, you see.
Mm-hmm. There are all sorts of ways of doing this,
yes,
but it's all the same method.
You see, on Anvil Creek, they worked it four ways. They first shoveled it. Men, I did plenty of that. I worked 100 shifts on the shoveling in. Then they took horses with scrapers and scraped it up and dumped it in, you see.
Oh, yes.
Then they had a hydraulic dish that gathered the water and washed it with the down with this water.
Mm-hmm.
And then they finally, a dredge worked the entire creek and all four operations paid.
Mm-hmm. All of the creeks around Nome leading into the sea were all pretty rich, weren't they?
All carried gold, some more and some less.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever heard a figure as to how much gold was taken out of the Nome area?
Well, I know.
You do?
There were 500 million taken out right around Nome.
Think of it.
It was out of there. Records show that was the gold that was bought, one thing or another. I know several of my friends that made nice steaks. That I always happen to get, and I got a mine there. We got down and thawed down and was thawing into it, and this morning when I pulled out the points, I put in a thaw all that night, came and pulled out an awful lot of water. Never seen so much water of a thaw, you see. Well, I finally got it all cleaned up, and was started digging in on the face. The next thing I know, I heard a google, 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 and the water just commenced to shoot in the stream out of one of these point holes. Well, I called for the hook, and I sent my all my points and all that gear up, you see, and then I sent up my tools, and I was standing in on my
You're
toes.
Down at the bottom of this hole now,
yeah.
All this time.
I was standing, and I pulled my hip boots and pulled them up, and I was standing on my toes when they finally got the rope back, and I could sit in the water, followed me up the shaft when they're within 10 feet of the bottom of the shaft.
How deep was the shaft then?
Only about, not quite, I think it's 28 feet.
That's too deep with water coming in. My goodness, you had struck a spring or a stream or something, hadn't you?
Solid ground.
Oh, I
was getting dollar and a quarter and dollar and a half pounds that night when I quit, you see, to put in the new thaw. I thawed the shed and took it out there.
Was that the end of that one?
Well, it was for me. I tried to sink a couple of holes, but I thought I could take and timber down through this, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And well, we worked all day, and I would dig under and then slip the 6-inch boards through and make them so that they would hold against each other, and then take that dirt out and then put another one down and work there, and I got down about 4 feet. And in the morning when we went out, all the timber was laying right on top of the water.
Mm.
So,
oh, dear, that's pretty discouraging.
I let somebody else.
Well, did you continue mostly in the gold mining?
Well,
what else did you do?
Lady, you know, you got to keep busy.
Mm-hmm.
And you take a leash and go out and test it, and maybe it didn't turn out that you could, a lot of that ground that I had turned down, I couldn't work at shoveling, but they've worked it with a bulldozer, mm-hmm. and made good money at it,
mm-hmm.
because the volume of dirt that they can move. Now, this USS and R&M company, they've drilled most of that bite that Nome's in. You see, here comes out, Quartz Creek comes out there, and Cape Nome here. This bite goes back in like that, probably, mm-hmm. it'll average 3 miles wide.
Sort of a semicircle.
Yes, and in that bite there, they claim there's over $5 billion of recoverable gold.
Still
but
there.
The sum of it is 180, 200 feet deep. Well, it's gravel. Now, I know a friend of mine, he and his partner sank a hole 118 feet deep in that gravel, all frozen, and they never got skunk from the top to the bottom, but they never found any concentrated.
Mm-hmm.
So that, but now when you concentrate that all down, you take 118 feet of gravel, you can get, and they maybe say we're a cent to 3 cents to a pan all the way down. Well, you concentrate that down, you got a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
But to get that water there and get that concentrated down, you don't do that for a peanut.
No, it's hard work. Well, let's see. In the meantime, Nome is growing, and
I helped build that railroad up there and operated on it, ran on it, ran.
You did.
Yeah.
That goes from Nome to where?
It went back 90 miles back to the Kugrok mining section.
Mm-hmm. Does that still operate, Charlie?
No. Uh-huh. No. That, when they 1918, when they took all the boys away from there, why, the mining kind of went, and anyway, it was a one-way operation. They had no freight to haul back,
mm-hmm.
and it hauled passengers and freight in.
Mm-hmm.
See, one trip there, I know, that I took in the fall, they were shipping their outfits up there, and I collected $1,100 on that one round trip, you see,
mm-hmm.
freight and passenger fares and one thing another like that.
Of course, if you could have done that every trip, it would have been a little different.
Sure, but you couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm. So you mined gold, and you worked on the railroad. What other things did you do?
Well, I was Judge Loman appointed me U.S. Marshal during the Prohibition days, and mm-hmm. I was Marshal there under Coolidge and Hoover.
What years now would
that
this
would
be?
That would be it's 24 to about 33, I think, mm-hmm. about 9 years I was in there, see.
I'll bet you had some adventures when you were a marshal.
That was a hell of a job.
I wouldn't
be a flat-footed bull. I'd rather think good of people than I would evil. And
mm-hmm.
You know, if the person watches and sweeps all the filth away from front of their own door, they got a pretty good job.
That's true.
And to, of course, I may not approve of it, but I'm like the girl that was caught in the act of adultery and brought to Christ, and she says, now what will he do with it? Well, he says, what's the law? Says she should be stoned to death. Well, that's all right, but says, ye who without sin among you cast the first stone. They didn't throw any stone.
Of course not.
Well, now you know the difference. These preachers today, they'll tell you you're going to hell. What'd he say? Here she's caught. Right in the act. I said, neither do I condemn thee. Go home and sin no more.
Sin no more. That's the important part.
I'm not trying to pose or anything like that, but that's my attitude in life. I may not approve of people. I had a partner, the reckless kid, and I had no respect for him whatsoever. He was not truthful, and he had no regard for women. There's only one thing with a woman, with him. Didn't care who she was, or how old she was, or how young she was. And I couldn't respect him, but I couldn't help liking him.
Mm-hmm.
He cost me plenty of money, too. Mm-hmm.
What do you think was the most difficult job you had while you were marshal?
Oh, well, the whole of it was difficult. Because in the first place, I just did a little incident to show you. I had a search warrant for a Finn woman up there. She ran one of these Finn bathhouses. And I went down there, and there was a truck standing in front of her door with a case of homebrew beer in it. And on the table in where she went in, there was two bottles, butts with butts of beer in them, and two glasses with butts of beer in them, and money laying on the table. And anyway, in her case, I got 1,750 bottles of beer.
This was during Prohibition days, of course.
And I took that down and put it in the vault, and her attorney waived a hearing, bound her over to the grand jury to be tried in front of the grand jury. So when I went in, testified before the grand jury and defining what I'd found and all, had my deputies that testified, and they made a true bill. Well, when it came to her trial, they had a fellow named Doc Welch. Now, I know Doc had no use for Prohibition, see. But he's a likable fellow. He's a good doctor. So when he was put on the stand, we had no machines to test the alcoholic contents of this stuff at all, see. And he took some litmus paper and stuck it down, took the cap off of it and stuck it in. Well, he says, it's vinegar. Well, the jury, that was all they needed. It's a note. So I had to empty all of those 1,750 bottles and take them back to her.
Oh, dear.
Well, now, you're up against that, mm-hmm. See. And I got a tip one time where a fellow was running a still up on Basin Creek. So I took a deputy and we went up on the left limit of the creek, clear up to the forks, and found nothing. So we came down on the right limit, and there was a big bunch of willows that we'd gone by, very heavy, high water willows, see. We'd gone by them going up, see. We came by and over, I see the canvas in front of it, and all sod and willows all over the top of it, and I see a still standing out in front there. So my deputy was a married man, had two small children, so I told him, now I said, you pull that curtain aside and I'll stand there, and because he'd sent word to me if ever I came for him he'd come a shooting me. So when he pulled it back, why, he started to get up, and he had three gun belts on a post right by his bed, and he rigged for her, and I said, I got you covered, John. Put your hands down, come out. Come out your hands up. So we took him in. Well, he's very nice, married to a very nice girl. And I forget how much we got. We got quite a bunch of booze and a still, and I got him attempting to resist arrest, mm-hmm. You see. So had a fellow named Frawley, who was an attorney there, and he went up to the district attorney and wanted to make a compromise. And so the district attorney sent for me and said what I thought we ought to do. Well, I said, Fred, they said, you got a fine wife there. And if you can make him, she'd gone out that winter, and she's down in California. And I said, if you tell him is he leaves and make him pay a fine of $500 and we get rid of him, right, she may make a man of him out there. They did.
Did it work?
I got the finest letter from her thanking me for what I'd done. Mm-hmm. She said that she'd got him a job in a ice plant there and all, and he was a good worker and faithful, and they'd given him promotions, and they had started to buy their home, and said that her happiness was due to me and getting him out of there, see.
Doesn't that make you feel good to know that you made the right choice?
You know one thing, you have done something that's worthwhile anyway, because anytime you make anybody happy for a right act, mm-hmm. it's going to count.
Yeah. Oh, that's a wonderful story. Yes. There are more wonderful stories that Charles Jones has to tell, and we're going to get the rest of them later.
Born 24.
Mm-hmm. Did you have just the one son?
Yes, but I never advertised this because I always think of I adopted her two girls, and they were my girls.
Uh-huh. So you had three children. And your son still...
They were just small.
Mm-hmm. Your son is still in Alaska.
He's married to a girl he met when he was in the Army. Mm-hmm. And they got married, and he was drafted and sent to Hood, and then there I told him, I said, son, whatever examinations they have, I don't care what it is, shoeing horses, cooking, or anything else, you take them. Mm-hmm. And so he wrote me one day and said, Daddy, says, you certainly gave me wonderful advice. Says, I took every one of them, no matter what it was. And it says, we were out on our final, when they got out with carrying their mm-hmm. packs and everything else before they're getting ready to ship them for replacement, see. Mm-hmm. And this lieutenant called me in and told me to get to Camp Hood at 25 miles away from, take your whole equipment and get there, because he said, you've been given an appointment to the Army Special Training Program.
Wonderful.
Well, he started out, and there's a woman picked him up, you know, and he was packing with his pack and his gun and everything else, you see. And so she says, where are you going? He says, to Hood. Well, says, I'm only going 10 miles. Says, but I'll take you that far. And so when he got there, there was a ice wagon, and he said, where are you going? What do they call him? Not Bud, but Joe. Mm-hmm. Good Joe. Mm-hmm. Where are you going, Joe? He said, I'm going to Hood. Well, he's going, he said, I just know the ice is going to Hood. So he drove him right
in. He got
into,
all the way.
Uh-huh. To Hood, and he got in and turned all his equipment in, got his papers, and took his bath and stepped on the one end of the platform of the train that were going to cross to Raleigh, North Carolina. Mm. It came in the other end, and he was put in charge of the ones that had won these appointments.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, Dad, said, first time the Army played fair with me is as I rode in the cushions of a Pullman clear across the deep south. And ate in the dining car all the way.
Good for him. By the way, your experience in the field of law seems to me, would have been a good background when you became a member of the legislature.
Well, I was in the first legislature in 1912.
Mm-hmm. Was that in Juneau, Charlie? You went to Juneau?
Yes, ma'am.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a good training there.
Mm-hmm.
Ernie Collins and Henry Roden and I are the only members of that legislature alive.
Is that right?
And Ernie Collins, he's down in the home now, paralyzed. Tilly, his wife, she had broke her leg, and she's crippled so that she couldn't take care of him, mm-hmm. so they just paying their way down there because mm-hmm. he gets good treatment
in
there,
yes.
know, that hospital, and
mm-hmm.
and he's got a whole lot better.
Mm-hmm.
He's improved a whole lot, but she couldn't take care of
That's
him.
Right.
Over a crippled woman around there trying to, a man that couldn't help himself,
mm-hmm.
it's the only sensible thing to do.
Surely. How many years were you in the legislature?
Well, I... then I was busy after that, you know. I was mining and I mined for myself and worked for other people and then was marshal and was superintendent of the last road commission, and I used to mine. I wasn't superintendent, I was general foreman, and then I would mine all winter, see,
mm-hmm.
take out a dump and wash stuff and prospect and one thing. I worked most of the time by myself. And in 1918, I tried to enlist in the army, and they wouldn't take me. Said I was too old.
Oh, really?
So they had taken all the help away from Nome. You know, they had drafted every young man. See.
Mm-hmm.
So I swept my decks on the Victoria to get out, and I went to work in the shipyards.
Where was this?
At,
Washington.
Seattle, in the
mm-hmm.
Golden Garden. Shipyard
mm-hmm.
is out upon the, it's on the sound up above
mm-hmm.
Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And I went down there and the gate, and I got hired on the gate, and the second day I was there, why, they gave me a boss's job.
Hmm.
And then there was a week why I was, after the next week why I made assistant to the labor boss for the yards here.
Did you work there all through the war
and
then?
I worked there, I worked all that summer, and I could see that the end was coming. So I quit and went to work for the Seattle Hardware Company there. So it happened before everybody else was quitting. Why, I got in there and got on that, never sent men back from the front too
yes.
at that time. Mm-hmm. See, and I was there when that false alarm went about the, had the celebration when it wasn't true.
Oh yes, I've heard about that.
And then they had another one later.
The so. Real one.
Yeah.
That was quite a celebration.
Yeah. Well, I...
Did
you know, I was used up to know everybody. You speak to everybody, mm-hmm. don't care who they are. Mm-hmm. You talk to them and people are friendly, see. And so I'd speak to people and they'd look at me. Well, it just made me feel like a 2 cents for the dog meat tied up with a pink string, see. So I stopped doing it. I wasn't happy.
Mm-hmm.
So when I saw the Victoria making her last trip to Nome, I went home and I wrote my father. He and I were very close. And I said, I want to go back to Alaska.
You were getting kind of homesick, weren't you?
No, I wasn't homesick. I was
homesick for Alaska,
yeah.
for Nome.
Yeah, so I want to go back to Alaska, to her tundras, her mountains and streams, full of salmon, trout and grayling, to add zest to your pork and beans. I want to go back to Nome and land on that desolate shore, and to see an aurora bore and to hear a blizzard roar. I want to go back in the mountains with a shovel, pick and pan, mine in the river bottom, just standing my own as a man. I want to see the daylight, follow the clock around, and winter's steel like moonlight, blowing the snow-covered ground. And I want to drive a dog team at 40 degrees below, and see in the darkening twilight the lights from a roadhouse show. And to know again the welcome from boys who have lived the same, and to do my part in her making right to the end of the game. And by God, I'm still trying.
You certainly are. Charlie, you have just brought up another thing I was going to ask you about, and that's your poetry. I understand that you've been composing poetry for a good many years. I hope you have a few more for me, if I can get on the right subjects. By the way, another question I wanted to ask you. Somebody said that I should ask you a story about one time a stove blew up. Was this your wife that this happened to?
No. That was a girl that was in the chain, from the chain. But I was Bob Summers' right-hand man, his confidential agent up there, when he built those two fields, those two airplane fields up there. He and my brother Dan had been partners, and he knew me, so he's keeping $250,000 on checking account there in Nome, and he wanted to know who signed those checks. And so I took care of that, took care of the check account, and signed the checks when the superintendent was drowned, see, because he knew that he'd get the square break from me, see. So this girl was a, I had Al Paulette's wife working as a stenographer, not as a typist. She couldn't take dictation, and I had 125 men on the payroll, and I had to get their paychecks out every week, and it was, I had to keep busy. So this girl and Louise got to go into their coffee break together, and we had rented the Patterson Hotel and had that for the, all our traveling. The CAA, when their people came through, we took care of them there, and we took care of all of our foremen in there, and people going through, that kind of people, what we had. We ran a mess house, I ran a mess house, and so it was in October when they shut down the outside work, and this girl had rented a house there from a fellow named Charlie Mason, just called the checkerboard, just painted with like a checkerboard scene. And of course Louise wasn't working anymore, but she was working there for Weens in the office and living in the checkerboard. And I came down there this morning. She was sitting in there, her stove had exploded, and she was just black with that there carbon soot from head to her toes, and the only what was on her were her tears that trickled down her cheek, you see. Oh, goodness, she sure looked like a hard Saturday night. So I sent our utility man over, cleaned out the stove, and thawed out their drain, and had things all cleaned up for her, and he mopped up the deck some, and put a big pot of hot water so it was all boiling and all when she went. Of course, when she got home, she was happy as a clam at high tide, see. So
it's funny to us now, but I'll bet you it wasn't a bit funny to her when it happened.
Never is, and yet. So I wrote these lines and mailed it to her, you know. As soon as she got it, she, you wrote that, you wrote that. If you are a woman and live in Alaska, plan, take an expert's advice and get yourself a man. He may be a diamond in the rough, and manners far from strong. But handy to have around when things go wrong. When the drain freezes up and the oil won't flow, and the thermometer outside stands at 42 below, and a 3 days blizzard piles the snow before the door, and a grocery they have failed to send from the store, he'll don muck and park and go cheerfully to boot if he really thinks you intend to feed the boot. He shoulders if you're weepy, and he takes you on his lap or handy to cry upon if you're that kind of sap. He may growl and grumble and be a devil, too. Perhaps, brother, sister, there's a bit of it in you. Now, marriage is a gamble, as all the records show, is how to live in Alaska. That I know.
I certainly agree. You know, really, you've put your finger right on it. I've often thought the reason that we can put up with the things that we put up with here in Alaska, I, for instance, are having a dependable man to lean on and cry on once in a while. Well, let's get back to politics, for instance. Do you think that first legislature did a good job, Charlie?
Lady, all you got to do is to go and read the record. of all the laws that we passed in 1913, there's only three of them that have been knocked out.
Is that right? That's a
they
good
They all
record.
Stand there. Why? Every one of us had a copy of the Enabling Act laid on our desk, mm-hmm. and a loose copy of the inhibitions. You were not allowed, in the first place, it started out and said the territory had nothing whatsoever to do with the primary disposal of the soil. So the territory didn't own any public land, did they? Mm-hmm. All right. Then it goes on and you couldn't grant a divorce and you couldn't do this and you had certain limitations, and that comes down and says the territory, there no political subdivision thereof, shall appropriate any public monies for the use or benefit of any denominational, sectarian, or private school, or any school not under the direct control of the government. Now, anything that came in to our Judiciary Committee, we'd look at it, and if it had one of those inhibitions in any way applied, down the drain.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it shows by doing that, they had nothing left. It was only a matter of ideas.
Yes.
When they tested our laws and they stood up.
Mm-hmm.
They stood up.
Sounds to me as if there were more things you couldn't do than there were things you could do.
No, you had plenty of latitude.
Mm-hmm.
But we could not grant an incorporation for a town.
Mm-hmm.
An incorporation for a town had to be applied to Congress, and then they made modifications in this thing. Mm-hmm. It was all laid out there. If you can get one of those, volume 1913 that was issued by Congress, the Enabling Act,
mm-hmm.
for, you'll find that those fellows, that they were Western people,
mm-hmm.
and that they covered conditions very well. But another thing that they didn't cover, because those, they were all people that had lived in territories, the now states, you see. Well, now, in a state, a service would be governed about how far a man could travel in a day on horseback. Well, a man on horseback would be just up against it up in Alaska, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that, for instance, you had 5 days to do a thing in a state, why, it didn't fit at all. So in 1912 or 1913, we fixed a lot of those up.
Mm-hmm.
And we would do it to our own. Now, for instance, if you went to drive for dogs from Nome down to Unalakleet, it was 8 days. 8 days good traveling.
Mm-hmm.
And go to Candle, it was 12 days.
Mm-hmm.
And Deering, 14 days. And to Kotzebue, it would be 24 days. Well, now, so that all of those things, those mechanics of, mm-hmm. administering the law, well, we took care of them as we, at that time. Now, well, you know, we got very few roads up in our part of the country, but you can go anywhere in a bush pilot if you want to go. They land on bars.
Mm-hmm.
And so that the times when the Constitution, they took care of a lot of that, but that Constitution is a miserable affair.
The state Constitution.
Yes.
You think they didn't do as good a job as you
know they didn't.
Did.
I know they didn't because I know those fellas. I don't care what they say about me. If you ask anybody the same thing, they'll tell you I don't lie. And they'll tell you I'm a stubborn old man. Well, if I think the thing's right, that's it as far as I'm going. Now, I'm Republican, but they can't pick some rattle-headed idiot and a fellow working for his own interest, just because he comes out and claims to be a Republican, get me to back him. I won't do it. I want to know what he is.
Mm-hmm.
It's like this Goonie. You ever read that in the Bible about the man that built his house on the sand?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's Goonie. That man is he is an absolute. I'll tell you one little thing. This is absolute evidence. Right to the Pan American, they'll tell you the same thing. when they were making that discovery flights to try and fly between Honolulu and Australia. After they got it all decided and got places that they could refuel on the way, they give a courtesy flight to a lot of prominent people. He and his wife were in Honolulu at the time, and damn if he don't get on that flight. Well, when they came back and commenced to chicken up, why, he didn't issue no invitation, and they sent him a bill for it. He went to every financial, every one of the divisions of the government in Juneau and tried to get them to pay that bill. And he made the mistake of going to old Billy Hesse, who was the head of the roads. And that fellow was just as straight as a string, and bawled him out. Oh, how he did bawl him out. And you could hear it all over the state house, the boys told me about it. I had a row with him, and I told him, I said, I'll tell you, Herbert. I said, I've analyzed this letter. I took it sentence by sentence. I found the nigger in the woodpile. You were trying to write this letter to make me think that you were behind, but I was acting. There he is, right there. That's an inferential lie. And I said, I'll not believe any statement that you make that doesn't have the absolute facts substantiated. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, he came up here, he was up here the other day, and he came over. I sat around quite a bit. I don't like to walk anymore than I have to, you see, and there's quite a bunch that have been over there for some reason, brother. He comes over, well, Charlie, old boy, how are you? And then he respects me, but I know that he just run a snicker snee into me as far as he could, you know.
Oh, Charlie. Huh? Let's get you back on the subject of your poetry. When did you first start writing poetry?
Well, now, I don't like this for publication.
Well, okay. Well, you just tell me then.
Well, this is a... I didn't have any idea ever getting married, you see. Up there, I was up there. I liked being out in the hills and being around, and I lived an awful lot sinking holes by myself.
You just didn't want to be tied down, I know.
Well, right. So, and I liked to dance, and the pioneers had dances, you see, and card parties, and I was working about 5 miles from the town, so after supper, why, I'd come in and go to these dance and card party, and this night I come in, I saw this little Jane sitting on the wall there, and she looked pretty good, you know, so I went over and got an introduction to her, and she looked like she was a good dancer, she was, so and Josh and talking with her and one thing and another. I don't know how I ever did it, but I asked her if I could take her to the next party. And she said yes. So I'd come in and take her to party, and after party, and I'd go on back and go to work again, you see. So this time there was one of these Tom Cod aristocrats had the party there, see, and I never went to their parties. I was a roughneck. So, I came in town. I generally get a bath when I come into town, too, see, and so I said, oh, well, I'll buy a ticket up in the gallery to see what's going on, see. The first person I saw was my little lady there with another fella. He didn't set very good. So I went and I wrote her. The outer space in which we whirl is a drab and dirty yellow. And the reason for a certain lovely brown-eyed girl is with another fella. The taste of life is dull and flat, but it should be rich and mellow. And the reason for it is that she's with another fella. The song of life is dull and drear, the bass notes of a shella. And for me always will be, dear, when you're with another fella. But didn't have very good horsepower. She married another fella going out on the boat.
Oh, that's a sad end to that story. So that was when you first began putting these wonderful rhymes together. Have you ever written them down, Charlie, or well, are they all in your head?
That woman come over to my house, you know Mrs. Audrey Loftus?
Yes, I think I do.
Well, she came, Grace Butterbitch and I are great friends, and Johnny and all, mm-hmm. and so Grace told me, she says, when you go over to Nome, well, you be sure and go see Johnny's or Charlie's boar's nest.
So, is that what you call your place?
Yes.
Or is that what she called it?
Well, it's a regular boar's nest. You know, yes. I know where everything is. And mm-hmm. it don't make any difference to me if there's a hole in the linoleum or my dishes are always nice and clean and mm-hmm. my cooking gear and I cook what I want, but I've got magazines from the floor to the ceiling, pardon there, and I got papers and I got letters and everything else, you know. And so she told me over there, she says, Charlie, I've got to go out and see your house. Grace told me not to come away from here till I've been out and seen your cabin. All right, I said, when you want to go, she says, whenever you say, well, you, whatever satisfies you. So we took her out, and of course, when I went in it, seeing some of these women's houses, you know, with everything, just, well, you know, I was a little bit embarrassed. And I said, I'll tell you, Audrey, I said, I'm going to get a couple of women here this summer, and I'm going to separate all these letters, and the ones that don't count, I'm going to have a big bonfire. She said, Charlie Jones, if you burn one of those letters, I'm going to have you arrested for malicious destruction of valuable property. Says, I'll be over here this summer, and I'll go through this stuff, and I'll take what I want for the museum over there.
I hope she did.
She did. She got 55 pounds of stuff. But heaven's alive,
I bet there are a few hundred pounds still left there.
Oh, all kinds of stuff. And so she asked me about my writings, and well, of course, I had the scribbled parts, and all I just chuck them in there together, you see, it's about that high, you see. So she copied some of them, mm-hmm. took some over to Fairbanks and had them copied and sent them back, see. And
well, I'm glad to hear that, because
and now I worked for the Weens this summer, entertaining the tourists.
Mm-hmm.
And they got me to recite a lot of my stuff for them. They all, I don't know whether it's just novelty or what, but they very flattering in there that I should have that published and all that. Well, I never wrote a thing of this to publish it. Like if it struck me and I could write just a few lines about the interest you show in listening to my gabble, you know, that'd be something. That's just owning it. Like my father's and my daughter's. Mm-hmm. My daughters, when they got growing up a little bit, when they're both beautiful children, and I'd go home and I'd find my doorway cluttered up with these young punks, you see. So that was bad enough. But then when my wife ordered me out in the kitchen to sit on the hard-seated wooden chair while they entertained these punks in the upholstered furniture, it didn't set very good.
And I bet you wrote a poem about that.
So, this night when they had a punk in there that I wouldn't had in the house, but I'm only daddy, I wouldn't know anything about that, you see. So I wrote and pinned a copy of it on each one of their pillows so they'd be sure and see it in the morning. And I said, there never was a woman who didn't want to feel that to every man she met, she made some appeal. Be she born to silk, satin, cotton, or reindeer, for as soon as she was big enough, she wanted men to notice her. And when she'd put the brand on the one and only one to give a bit of tingle to every mother's son. Now in my life along with women and living out the plan, it's been my observation her chief end is man. They both got mad at me.
Oh, I think that's a wonderful way to conclude. I think the best way to wind up an interview with Charlie Jones is with one of his delightful poems, and I just hope I'll be able to run into more of them.
Well,
thank you so much, Charlie,
I'm
for coming.
Going to, on account of these people all on one thing or another, I'm selecting a bunch of them, and I'm going to have them copyrighted.
Fine.
And I'm going to submit them to this fellow that published services poem, because if it strikes their fancy, well, maybe they might figure it. Well, maybe it struck alive and with service, maybe we can do it again.
Good. I hope they do. Yeah. And when you have a book published, I sure want to have a copy.
All right.
Thank you, Charlie, for coming. This has been a real pleasure. Yeah. I've so enjoyed it.